Welcome to Playful Beginnings, a podcast about the magic of play therapy for therapists, students, and anyone interested. In our podcast, we'll explore the deeper understanding of play therapy and the skills we use when working with children.
We hope to help you understand the why behind what we do and how it helps kids heal and grow. I'm Dr. Christy Opiola, a working play therapist and university professor in North Carolina.
I'm Dr. Maggie Parker, a play therapist and professor in DC.
You're going to be my therapist today.
No, I think it's good. So just an introduction for everybody. We are here with Dr. Jen Balch. I know you as Jen Ware. Am I saying it accurately?
Yeah. Well, Ware's my maiden name. Balch is my married name. And yeah, and you got it. You pronounced it exactly right.
Phew. Yes. So Christy and I know Jen from graduate school when we were all taking play therapy together. I don't know.
Jen was actually my mentor coming in. Oh, wow. She was my doc student. Do you remember that, Jen?
Yeah. Now that you say that, I had completely forgotten that.
Yeah. She was the person that I received coming in as the person I could connect with before I started the program.
Oh my That's gosh. Awesome. But that does seem a billion years ago.
I know, right?
It does feel a really long time.
Well, and speaking of that, Maggie, when I started, because I think you were one cohort above me, right? And I remember you speaking to my class and just as a group about the experience. And this one phrase you said has stuck with me. Literally, I've used it so many times in reference to the doc program, but I remember you saying, this program is reaching into your soul, yanking out your heart and examining it.
Oh, God.
I remember you saying that and I was like, wow, that is
graphic.
That is. And then as I went through the program, like, oh, wow, she was right. We got a lot of therapists needing to look at ourselves so we can help.
I think that's one of the things that I really appreciated about our program, actually, is the connections and how I think through the relationships that we formed with our faculty and with each other, that we went really deep. So Jen, you are the co-owner of University Park Counseling and Testing, yes?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's in University Park. Where is that located? Well,
so we started off right in the heart of University Park, but as we grew, we had to move to a larger space. So we're actually in Dallas proper still, but we're a little bit outside of University Park. So anybody in the Dallas area that is familiar, we're right at Preston and 635.
Got it. So, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so one of the reasons why Christy and I reached out to Jen is because she's in Dallas. And the nature of the work that she does, she was both familiar with working with kids who've experienced trauma and crises like this, and specifically what's happened in Texas with the flooding. Christy has a lot of experience working with survivors from North Carolina. And because we all were in school in Texas and from Texas, I think Jen and I, and Christy, I don't know if anybody, but Jen and I did know friends who were airlifted out of Mystic, and we know friends who've lost their daughters. And so I think what I was hoping that we could do, Jen, is help not just other play therapists who are, we always say just play therapists who might be working with children who've experienced tragedy, whether it be what's happened in Texas or North Carolina or across the spectrum. And then also what parents, communities, teachers might look for when you have something of this grand scale. I think one of the elementary schools where I grew up in Dallas lost 3 or 4 girls all going into the third grade. And so that's a big impact that's going to rock the community. And so I was hoping we could talk generally about how to support each other. And then also, I think maybe as play therapists, how do we help work with parents right now? Because we're probably going to be getting a lot of calls from families. And so I think sometimes that can feel overwhelming as a play therapist of how do I do this? How do I handle this?
Yeah, I think that there's so many different points that you just brought up. And I think as play therapists, when we have these big tragedies happen, it's kind of hard to balance because we have a certain skill set that we know can be helpful and useful and supportive to people. But at the same time, we can still feel just as helpless as so many other people and scrambling to figure out how can I help? What can I do? And so that can be really overwhelming because we also still need to take care of ourselves. And especially if we are feeling impacted for whatever reason, in whatever way that means, we really need to take care of ourselves. And if we're stepping into a role where we are now helping support people through this same trauma that we're still hurting from, we have to be really aware of that and take care of ourselves and our own needs. And that it reminds me a little bit of, I mean, on a different scale, but COVID, counselors who are experiencing something while also supporting others who are experiencing something similar and trying to find a way to balance all of that. So I think that's really important for play therapists to be aware of and not feeling guilty if you can only take on so many of these types of clients, or not feeling you're doing enough. Whatever is meaningful for you and intentional for you and what you feel you can and want to do is okay. I think that's an important place to start.
I also, almost a year ago, our state was hit really, the western part of our state was hit by a hurricane, and many families were impacted. Many people lost their lives, lost everything they own, as well as the infrastructure in our town, which is going to, I think Kerrville or Kerr County is going to experience some of those same things. What we found in North Carolina is that first and foremost, we need to add to community support. So link into your community, make sure you're reaching out to groups and lean on the big organizations, American Red Cross, that's going to come in. Lean into the, if there's any type of church supporting and other stuff. Individual help is amazing, but it often overwhelms the systems that are trying to support the community. Individual families are different, but the community as a whole, we have to be somewhat mindful that we have to respect the community's wishes and how they're seeking support and what they're wanting. And then the thing we're learning in North Carolina is this is long-term care. This is not temporary care. We actually did not get a lot of referrals immediately because they were in such crisis. And it was just different and similar, I think, to probably how most of Texas is feeling. Most of North Carolina felt connected to the community that was really impacted. Either we vacation there, we have family there, colleagues there, or we have really fond memories of the area, or experiences in the area. And so we're finding, and as you read about natural disaster, it's sometimes the 1 to 5 year support. Mm-hmm. So for play therapists who may feel incapacitated at the time, right now in Texas, that's okay. Honor that in yourself and know that you can still play a big role in supporting this community and the families that were involved, because they may not reach out for 3, 6 months to a year after, and when they're really going to start to seek supports for what's happening.
Yeah, I think that's such an excellent point. I was teaching my internship class last night, and we were talking about that same thing. Some of them had not had many clients yet. I mean, this is still so fresh. And we were talking about that same concept that you may not see people bringing their kids in, or families coming in, or adults coming in because they were impacted, or they're as parents, or maybe they have a family member who is there, they were there themselves, or whatever. We may not see that right away, but we might see it 6 months down the road. We might see it once the initial kind of shock has worn off, and they maybe feel they're less in survival mode, and they now have the capacity to seek out personal support. We might see that. And I also think that I won't be surprised if we see an uptick in particularly kids reaching out, or parents reaching out for their children for play therapy around the time that school starts.
Yeah.
Because I think that's going to be a trigger time for a lot of families who are not sending their kid to school this year, or a kid's friend is not going to be there this year, or just some kind of reminder. Maybe teachers are in class and a student they had last year is not there this year, or or just even the collective, maybe as teachers, hearing kids talking about it and then that being triggering for them, or they might feel at a loss and not knowing how to support these children. So whatever way that's kind of impacting, I can see kind of come August or a kind of towards the beginning of the school year, there being a need that people are aware of to get some mental health support.
And I think it's important also to recognize that, especially for adults, I think, and I'll say it for myself, right? I found out about what was happening. I made the docs, I connected, and I was crying, right? Immediately, I'm having an emotional response. But children don't always present that way when dealing with grief or trauma. So for any adults listening that are around children right now, if they just are acting quote unquote normal, that doesn't mean that they're not impacted. It maybe hasn't hit them yet. They're going to express it differently than just sitting down and crying. So even when you have conversations with kids about death, usually it's, oh, or in my experience, they're like, oh, okay. And then they kind of go on. And then later, it may even be 3 months later, they're really upset about it. And it just kind of sinks in. And so that's something normal that children do. It's how they process those experiences. And I think sometimes, especially when adults are also grieving, it's hard to understand. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're okay. They're just going to present differently.
Yeah.
And I think we have to, oh, sorry. Go ahead, Jen. I'll go after you. I was just going to say, we have to remember that death is a really abstract concept to children, partly because most of their exposure to death has made it not absolute. So in video games or on TV shows, or those are probably the two main spaces that things die and then they come right back to life. They get to redo something, right? Or the character is on the show in the next episode. It doesn't feel as absolute and concrete as we understand as adults. So, and working with a lot of grieving children, for our caregivers out there, it's not uncommon that you'll say that and they'll say, oh, okay. And then they'll move on. And I typically see kids go to seek opportunities to play. They're trying to make sense of it. So make sure if your kid goes to play, it doesn't mean they've moved past it. It may be that they're trying to make sense of what you've shared, as well as they're probably going to ask again, which is really hard as a caregiver, that these are repeated conversations that happen. When is so-and-so going to come back? Or can we go to the place that they were to go visit them? And even if you do funerals and burials or whatever rituals, right, that we have around death, that still is not going to make it super concrete for kids. It's going to take a while for that to absorb in for them that this is permanent. The other thing for our caregivers out there, teachers, parents, grandparents, you're grieving too. So these are really hard conversations to have with your kids. They're not easy. There's tons of resources out there that can help support you in these. We will make sure we link them to the podcast at the bottom, as well as I'm working on putting some resources up on our page, which is playtherapyspace.com, so that you have some places to go to help have these conversations with kids. But they may ask, and I think oftentimes we want to protect kids from a lot of things. So we try to be stoic and other stuff. It's okay to be emotional with your kids. You're hurting too. Mm-hmm. So as you explain it and you're tearing up or crying, that's okay. Mm-hmm. Your kid is feeling that same thing. If you present always as stoic, they're going to feel they should not have emotion around this. So allow yourself to grieve at the same time. And if it's too overwhelming, who are the other people in your life that can help support you in talking to your kid about this? Is there a best friend, a grandparent, someone at the school, a school counselor, a counselor in the community that you can reach out to help have these conversations or be able to answer those questions? And I know in my time, both as a therapist, as a child life specialist, right? Talking to parents about saying, that's a really good question. And I'm not sure I can answer it right now. Give me a few minutes or give me a day or two so that you can get yourself back together. Just remember to come back to the conversation so that they know they can come to you Or if you ultimately can't answer it, I'm going to ask so-and-so to talk to you about that. Not because I don't want to. I don't know how to express this with you right now or how to share this with you right now because I'm hurting too, right? And so, and you can join your kid in those conversations instead of avoiding or kids thinking that they can't come to you.
Yeah. And I think giving yourself permission too. So it's not even just the questions that they have that you don't know how to answer, but maybe you can't emotionally, it's becoming overwhelming for you. And so knowing, are you still in a place where you are able to support your kid in this conversation? And yes, we want to model that we have emotions too, and it's okay to feel sad. And that can sometimes feel validating and give permission for children to feel their feelings too. And there can be a lot of good in that. But if our emotions are becoming pretty dysregulating for us, and we see maybe the child then feeling this need to take care of us, that might be when we need to take a step away. Yeah. And it's okay to say, I'm feeling really overwhelmed. I'm feeling so sad right now that this is actually really hard. I'm going to take a break from this conversation and we'll come back to it. That's okay too. And you're really modeling a lot of healthy things for your child, because sometimes hard things happen and we do need to take a break, and having enough self-awareness to be aware of that and allow yourself to kind of have that boundary and step away from something and come back. I think there's a lot of good in that. And I think parents, I think you're exactly right. A lot of times there is this belief that we have to have all the answers and we have to act perfectly and we have to do all the things in all the right ways. And that's, we're human too. And so we can model that for our kids. I think that's really important.
Yeah.
I also, Christine, when you were talking about earlier, about the concept of death and how hard that can be for children. I also was thinking too, within that, for a lot of children that we're having this conversation with, it might be their first really experience with death too. And so in addition to exposure being in some of the things that you mentioned, movies or games or whatever, where they are coming back, sometimes they don't really know how they feel about it because they haven't experienced it. And that's so unique because most of the time the adult having the conversation with the child has experienced a loss. And so we can anticipate what it is to not be able to talk to this person again or see this person again. We know emotions that we have experienced in our own grief processes throughout life. And so we have all of these experiences that we're bringing into this conversation with the child. And so sometimes when they are saying, oh, okay, it's because they don't know how they feel yet. They've never experienced that. And that happened in my own home when I was sharing with my own kid that somebody she knew had passed away in the flood. And those were her exact words. Oh, okay. And then she didn't have a lot to say or ask in that moment. And certainly we left the conversation. If you have any questions, I'm here. If you want to talk about it, I'm here. And it was the next day that she brought it up and she had several questions for me. And then we sat down and talked about it more. And so that just in my own personal home, and I just, and my daughter will be 8 next month. And so right at that same age range, that's just spot on, I think, what happens for a lot of kids.
And I think
guess is it'll come up again. She'll continue to have questions and she may ask you the same questions again and again. Mm-hmm. And it's not that she's not listening. It is really part of that grief process. Our bodies can only take in so much information at a time, no matter our age. And those concepts have to be built because it may be the child's first experience. It may also be the parent's first experience with grief and loss too. And so I think we have to remember that as well, that parents may or may not handle grief well.
And it's a little different, right? So my kids have lost grandparents and that feels different than finding out that an 8-year-old has died. And I think it's important. I think one of the things I'm learning from Dr. Quinn Smelser, who's in Austin and also has a practice, but she does a lot of grief and loss and having conversations with children. We want to protect their innocence and we don't want to expose them to too much, but a lot, and this is also a religious camp and it's a very religious space. And so we often, when talking with children about death, use they went to heaven or they're now with Jesus or grandpa or Maymay, whoever it may be. And kids don't quite understand that. And then it gets really, I think for me, emotional when they're, well, I want to go to heaven too. And so how do you have conversations? And I think that's something to explore both as play therapists talking to parents about how to have these conversations and caregivers and teachers ourselves. What I've used with my children is there at some point your body stops working. And their bodies have stopped working. And so they are not here anymore. And it doesn't mean that you can't still use religion, right? I think that's really important. But how do we have a conversation so they can understand this isn't necessarily a space that they can go?
Yeah, that concrete language is so important. Children really need to understand that this person died. And that is so hard for a lot of parents to utter those words. But you're exactly right. If we say they've gone to sleep or they've gone to heaven or they passed away, those can be really vague terms to a child and sometimes really add confusion into the mix. And then even follow-up conversations can sometimes even feel harder when you're trying to clarify that. And so children really need to know that this person died and they're not coming back anymore. And so giving very factual information, and especially depending on the age of the child, in short kind of bursts, right? And so we can have very short conversations and then come back to it and kind of check in with the child, right? And so we don't have to give these long, extravagant explanations. So for my daughter, for example, she's almost 8 years old. She doesn't know a lot of the details of the flood. She doesn't know the number of people that have died. She hasn't been exposed to a lot of the media and the pictures because I've really limited, and it's been a struggle even as a parent who is educated in child development. It's even been a challenge for me trying to balance that. And so I imagine for a lot of parents, they are trying to balance that and trying to understand what is the appropriate amount of information to expose my children to. And so I wanted her to have some information about what happened, but I didn't necessarily feel she needed to know the broader, all of it was, I think, going to be too overwhelming for her. And going back to, so being concrete, this is what happened, is helpful, but also having the boundaries around that and knowing going into the conversation as much as you can, this is the information I want to share, so that you don't start maybe rattling off more than what that child can handle.
Yeah. And I think that there are some really precocious children, right? My son is almost 10, so he's older, and he knows someone who was airlifted out. And so having these conversations, and he's, well, how much, and he keeps asking. And I think we're, as caregivers, it's really tough, and where we want to know ourselves is you don't want out of your grief to blurt something out that maybe they're not able to take in. Mm-hmm. And so really trying to hold yourself in that space and take deep breaths and take care of yourself. And, I had something else and I forgot it. And also being mindful of the conversations that you're having around them. So if you're on the phone and you're talking to someone, or I'm sure I'm guilty of this, right? Of calling Christy or calling you or calling whomever, and being like, I lost so many of my friends' kids are gone and I don't know what to do and I can't handle this and it's too much. They're listening too. And so how can you find a private space? Because they're really great observers and really terrible interpreters. And so really trying to be mindful and aware of where you are when you're having those conversations, because you too need to have those conversations. That's okay to have those conversations. But then monitoring kind of where and then how you're engaging in those really short. I wonder if it would be helpful if we could come up with a couple of phrases that caregivers could use about it. Not necessarily always just about Texas, but about in general that you've used or you've, go ahead.
As far as when they need their own space to talk about it, or?
Either, or how you say it to the child.
So there are a lot of great resources. We could put some up, but I think linking to some things that already exist is really helpful. For young children, Sesame Street Workshops has some wonderful easy printouts and reminders of how to have these conversations with kids around emergencies, natural disasters, grief and loss, the natural stress, the National Childhood Stress Network also has a lot of great resources. One that I go to often is kidshealth.org. They have topics about everything related to kids' mental health as well as physical health. So they have stuff about medical needs, grief and loss. And then if you're looking specifically for grief and loss things, any of your local children's hospitals probably have something on their website around grief and loss, as well as there are some grief centers in many communities around the U.S., but probably the first one was the Dougie Center in on the West Coast, and they have a ton of resources and activities to help both have these conversations, but also help your kid process from young children all the way to young adults. And so they do give you the resources available. I think we could put some of those on our website for people, Maggie.
One other one I'll just add, I know that you'll put a list up, but particularly for parents who might really be struggling in knowing how to talk about death, one of my favorite books to read with children is When Dinosaurs Die. I've loved that book for, I don't know, 20 years. I use it all the time, or I'll give it to parents to use all the time. And so when a parent is giving the initial information about someone has died, but then don't know, they don't, maybe they feel at a loss of, okay, I've told them this, but now what? I don't know how to process it. Certainly getting them into play therapy can absolutely be an option. But even reading that book together can help give the parents a little bit of a guide for how to have some conversations too. And so even sitting down, and there are so many wonderful children's books, right? The Invisible String is a wonderful one. I mean, there's so many. And I think that can be a really great resource for parents that are struggling to know what exactly do I say? And how do I talk about this other than just giving the initial information to the child? But what comes after that? Books can be a really great, great concrete, tangible thing that you can read together, and sometimes, and then it's there, and then the parent and child have it. The child can go read it anytime. They can ask the parent to read it with them. They can pick it up on their own. But it can be a tool to really help them process and kind of make sense of their own feelings and grief and loss.
And as a former child specialist, I also want to put a warning out there, because there are a lot of terrible books about grief and loss. It's really important to read it first. Yes. Don't be the first time you read it is with your child, and read it aloud. So read it to yourself first and then read it aloud, because you're going to need to be able to state the words in there. And sometimes when we read aloud, we realize, oh gosh, my kid, this is not the right book for my child. And right. So it's just a helpful way as you're looking at books to make sure. The other one I love is, and it's going to sound odd, but Mr. Rogers, someone from our childhood, book just about death. That's very concrete for children, and it's called When a Pet Dies, but it really goes through what does it mean to die. So if your kid has questions about just death in general, that might also be another good resource to have on your shelf. And then if you're looking at memory making, The 10th Good Thing About Barney is one of my favorites. It's about how do we memorialize people? How do we keep their memory alive, and how do we keep the gifts that they gave us? Because I think oftentimes in grief and loss, we think about all that we lose. But there's also things as we remember our friends, and there's some wonderful things that our friends gifted us, right? Maybe it was their love for Taylor Swift, or the artwork they used to create for us, or how they had the best dance at the school assemblies, whatever it is. Those are gifts that people leave us, and those are memories that make grief easier and palpable to take.
And at the back of When Dinosaurs Die, they have some ideas of things you can do. And asking children, is there anything that you want to do, can be really helpful, because sometimes they will come up with things that we would never even think of. I would really like to have a red popsicle. That was her favorite. And that can be really meaningful and so easy for you to make happen. And sometimes they might not have anything they want to do, and that's okay too. But really checking in with them to see if there's something meaningful for them can be really helpful.
Jenna, I was also thinking, as you said, I want a red popsicle. That can also be a trigger down the road. So it also cues parents in maybe why all of a sudden they get upset about something 3 months later or 6 months later. So again, open communication is so important when you're talking about grief and loss with your kids, because it's really going to help you be able to provide more comfort and create a safe space for them.
Yeah. And that reminds me too of just a kind of a general reminder to any play therapists that are listening, to for them to remember themselves or have conversations with parents about, we've talked about how grief can, there's no timeline, right? I mean, but also behaviors and emotions and responses and reactions can really vary. Sometimes we might experience a lot of regression in the playroom, or the parent might be talking about a lot of regressed behaviors at home, or all of a sudden they're really angry, or something is very different. And maybe we look for that right away and we don't see it, but 3 or 6 months down the road, we see it. And maybe at that point, we're not making the connection because it's not seeming as recent, but it still is related, or it can be, and we want to explore that. I think that's important. And I think another really important thing to highlight when helping parents is helping them realize that, particularly in this situation, and when you're talking about grief and loss in children, is that their brains can only process it to a certain degree. So it is very, very that they are going to reprocess it again and again and again as they get older and they reach different developmental milestones. And so I always remind parents of that so that they can kind of just tuck that away in the back of their mind so they can be prepared for it and know when this happens that there's some normalcy to that. Maybe at that point they need to get back into therapy, or maybe they don't. Maybe it's just their brain is trying to make sense of this now in a new way because they're developed now in a different way. Cognitively, they can make sense of what's happened in this different way, and they're just needing to do that. And there's a lot of normalcy to that. But I think it can really freak out parents when 2 years down the line, they are all of a sudden talking about it again, and they're asking different kinds of questions or more questions. And the parents, oh my gosh, I thought they had gotten better. I don't know. And they have this worry that that's a negative thing. And so that's a reminder that I always to educate parents about. I think that's really important in whatever kind of grief we're talking about. But we see that a lot in children.
Go ahead, Maggie.
I was going to say, when I talk about grief and loss and trauma, even with adults, so when I'm teaching the course, is okay, so you could lose your a mom when you're 15 and you're going to grieve a certain way, but then you're going to grieve when you go to college, and then you're going to grieve when you're getting married. You're going to grieve if you have a child, because you're a different person in those spaces now. You have changed, and the loss means something different in those moments. And so it is absolutely something that just, it doesn't mean that you haven't gotten over it or that something's wrong. It's just that you're a different person now. And for children, especially, you're saying, both of you are saying, is you have the different capacities to understand it as well. Mm-hmm. And this is not something that just goes away. It's impactful. This is a big deal, and they're going to process it, and that's okay. And I think for caregivers, for teachers, for the adults that are around these children, your presence, your love, your understanding, your predictability, having the same routines, that is also really important. You don't have to fix it because you can't fix it, right? You can be with them and hold space for them and share the love that you have for them.
The other thing I was going to share is we're talking about single event grief experiences, but I also want to talk a little bit about natural disasters.
Yeah.
Because in particular around grief, right? Anxiety is a normal part of the grieving process, but grief around natural disasters, anxiety can be heightened because what caused this grief could happen again, or the initial thing where we have a bad rain or something. And so just be aware, even if your kid was not at the camp or on vacation in this very popular vacation spot in Texas, that just hearing about it, they may get anxious at times at home, right? That it's raining really hard, or puddles start to, or they have a flash flood warning on the TV. And that then everyone's anxiety is a little heightened, but in particular for kids, right? They can't make sense of, oh, our house is high enough up, or right. They're talking about just little flooding, not a river flooding or something like that. But so there can be some reoccurrence of fear. And then for those who were in the area or survived the natural disaster, that those tend to be sensitive times for everyone. And so everyone's going to be more heightened, anxious, on alert, and it's harder to support and comfort people at that time, because you also need comfort and support. And so little things, creating a safety plan so that we have where we need to go, what we need to do in those moments, are going to be really important.
We just had this, obviously, because we were connected in some ways to this, my children, we've been having conversations. And then we had two or three nights of flash floods in Virginia, and we live near a creek. And so the conversations, and of course our garage started flooding, and we're like, it's not the same. This is what we're going to have a conversation. And then it came back at dinner. And so my husband and I had to walk through, okay, so let's look at where the creek is next to our house. Do you remember how we have to go down a big hill there, and then we have to go down steps, and then we have to go further down? And they're like, yes. And I was like, okay, so let's think about, and we are up how high on this, on the second floor, how far down, and just being really concrete. And we had to have those conversations a couple times. And I know having a flash flood in Virginia is different than having a flash flood in Texas, right? But they don't know that. And so just having those very concrete, calm, patient conversations and answering those questions, I think, is important for parents, and they're going to come up.
And that's such a good reminder of how you just described having that is probably so natural to you as a play therapist. But as a play therapist, that's one way that we can really support parents, is how to respond when your child has this weather-related anxiety, because we will see it. When we had a tornado rip through kind of particularly my area of Dallas, and so we had a lot of clients that had real, legitimate weather-related anxiety. And it's not abnormal to have tornado sirens go up around here. And their fear was very rational, given their experience. And so I think we're going to see that same wave here. And Maggie, I experienced the same thing. We had a couple flash flood. We actually lost power two nights ago. And that was the first thing my daughter, oh no, is our house going to fill up with water? Is our house going to float away? And so having those detailed conversations, guiding parents, and not just saying, oh no, it's fine, you're going to be fine. Mm-hmm. That's a less than ideal response.
Yeah.
It can be invalidating, right, to the child. Mm-hmm. But also it doesn't comfort them. It doesn't make them feel better. I think that's the intent a lot of times of parents, but it doesn't work in the way that they're intending. But when you can help identify, when you can point out the rational things, when you can help identify, here are the things that we have in place to help keep us safe. Here's what we know about the weather, or whatever it might be pertaining to the event. Those are the things that are helpful. Very similar to how we might help a parent navigate a conversation about being scared of the dark and monsters, or instead of saying, you're fine, go to sleep. What are the things that we have in place to keep you safe, our house safe, all our family safe? Mm-hmm. And so when you can point out those things, it is much more helpful in reducing the anxiety for the child. And so that can be something that we can do in supporting parents. Cause I feel as trained play therapists, we have a lot of tools going into the playroom, knowing how to support children because of just naturally what we know about play and developmentally how that's helpful in helping children process a variety of emotions and experiences. It's really the conversations with parents that I feel play therapists can have, maybe need some support or some reminders, and the parents coming in and feeling really anxious or uncertain or asking us, oh gosh, how do I talk to my kid about this? Or what do I do when my kid asks me this or feels anxious about weather, whatever.
And I think for caregivers and teachers, we talk about this as play therapists a lot of, if you have enough to ask the question, you have enough to make a statement, right? And I think there are ways of just kind of like tuning in. And if you're, I'm wondering, I think they're sad, I'm not sure. You can just say, like, you're really feeling sad right now, or you're confused right now. And we're not, as adults, other than our play therapy people, trained to kind of pick up on those emotions. But if you're feeling it, you can say it, and it might help them feel really understood. And it's something, even my daughter was riding her bike today and she did a great job, but she had to cross a big street and you could see it. She was not, and that was overwhelming for you. I didn't need to say, "You, good job, you did it," or "You're fine." She needed to hear that was really scary, and kind of just sit with her in that moment. But sometimes we're okay, come on, come on, come on, and you don't remember. And sometimes when you can just say, "You're feeling really overwhelmed right now," or if you're picking something up from them, just to say it, because it does feel really connected. It does help them feel seen. But it's tough.
Absolutely. And validating, going back even to the modeling of how to show emotions and how to process them, and giving permission to feel all the different feelings.
And sometimes, I don't know if this is helpful for other people listening, but sometimes I just have big emotions. I'm an empath. I cry all the time. And y'all remember, because you went to school with me, but I'll cry and my son will all of a sudden he feels responsible for my feelings. And so I have conversations of, "Mommy feels sad, and it's not your job to make me feel better. I can handle feeling sad. I'm okay." And I think, one, it helps separate so that they don't have to take care of me. But two, also, I think models that we can handle being sad. Emotions are emotions, and they're not something to shy away from, and it's okay to have. And then it, again, as we said, if it's a point where you need to take a minute, go take a minute. I need some space real quick. I'm having a lot of big feelings. And just narrating it. I think that's where, as adults, we kind of forget. Is just saying, right now, this is what's happening, and naming it and saying it out loud can be really, really, really helpful for kids in their understanding of the experience.
Yeah. And also identifying and naming and being okay with our experiences being different. Mm-hmm. Right? So I'm feeling really sad right now, and it's okay that you're not.
Yeah.
Sad in this moment. Right. Or vice versa. If they're feeling really sad and we're comforting them, I think that's kind of maybe more normal. Mm-hmm. But if they're experiencing us feeling sad or tearful, I think for some kids, should I be sad too? What's, you know, kind of feeling in that? And so if we're picking up on that in our kids, I think it's important to put some words to that we don't have to be feeling the same things in this moment. And that's okay. And I know in the moms group that I'm a part of in my community, the moms are not okay. And it's hard, again, to kind of what I was talking about before, balancing. How can I support? I don't know. I can't do enough.
No. There's sometimes guilt that you're having a response if you weren't there. Or guilt if these little girls that did survive. My friend's little girl was airlifted out and she's with other people, their parents. I'm trying not to bother them. I just kind of send them hearts just to let them know that I'm thinking of them. But they shared that she was with her other camp friends and some of them had lost their little girls. And so then it becomes, but I was there too. And I'm okay. And that's a real feeling too. And they may not feel that, but they could. And just being open and having those conversations and holding space and lots of hugs, I think.
Yeah. I've thought of that too. I think there's so many lives lost in our community that people know, this family has lost their daughter. But there's so many families that were there or had family who was in the area that they couldn't get a hold of for a day or two and are feeling so traumatized by the experience. But I think there is some guilt in expressing that because there's lives lost. And then that, I think, is really hard. It's almost like politics. I don't even want to say who I voted for because I don't, you know, kind of people are afraid to talk about it. Well, if I'm not talking about the death of someone, then I'm not allowed to feel
Right.
Traumatized, right? I definitely think there's a sense of that going on too. And that's very much been on my mind is how can I support maybe those who are struggling to feel validated in their need for support.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of grief groups that have formed around the Dallas area, a lot of pro bono services and stuff. But I just, and some are specific for survivors, which I'm really glad to see, because I think that is kind of gives permission for those people to join and seek out those services. But that's definitely been on my mind too.
When I think,
I was just going to say, I think we also have to remember that I think this is impacting more than people who were involved in it, right? I think as a whole, we potentially may see parent-aged clients coming in and just talking about this. My kid goes to summer camp. It's not in Texas, but this could have, you know what I mean? Just the guilt and the what's coming up for people in this natural disaster, and the helplessness of there was nothing people could do. The other thing I was going to say, Maggie, to your response about it's such a great place to be with others who experience something the same, but they're for kids in particular, we have to also remember that there's a lot of imaginary responsibility that takes place, that when someone has survived, I have guilt because that person was holding my hand, or I didn't hold on long enough, or what if I had had them? They asked to sleep in my room last night, right? They almost feel they're responsible for what happened in the moment. And how do we help bring that conversation up? Because I don't know that kids always will say that out loud, but they experience it. It's not until they find a really trusted person will they even mutter. And then oftentimes they're just denied the feeling, no, 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 it's not your responsibility,
right?
Instead of giving them an opportunity to really explore it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is where therapy or working, even if parents work with a therapist to know how to respond in these moments, those can also be really helpful tools. Because I think many parents want to be the ones to help support their kids. They're not sure what to say.
I think
or how to respond. They're not trained. We are on this call.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that what you're saying is so important. It's just to let them talk. It just reminds me of stuff that Dr. Sue Braddon would say, and we use all the time with CPR when we teach child-parent relationship therapy, is like, if you had a bad day, would you want someone to say, oh, you should go get over it? Oh, or oh, you're fine. Oh, you should have done something different. Or wow, that's really hurtful. I think that's something that as adults we can relate to. And so also in those moments, if as an adult you're talking to a child who might be saying those things, it saying that was really, you're feeling really icky right now, or whatever it is that, and not just trying to shut it down, because I think that's an honorable thing that adults do because we're trying to protect them, and allowing them to know that we see them and hear them. And then maybe going into the later aspects of like, there's nothing you could have done, but in that initial moment, because then it also lets them know that you're a safe space to talk and that's what you want. And I think about this a lot because this happened in North Carolina, right? You were dealing with all of this and it felt very separate for me. And I probably didn't reach out as much as I should have because I was, oh, it feels really separate. And so now all of a sudden this thing in Texas, now I'm personally impacted. And I think what we need to remember is that people are going to be impacted by these things a lot. It's happening a lot. And if you're having a response, that's okay. Find your trusted person that you can have that response with, that you can allow yourself those moments, and then reach out to those who might be impacted by something else, right? We can support each other in a way that is very human and engaging and relational. And that I think is probably, I think it's just a really important piece to remember, is that we can reach out to each other and hold each other and give space to each other.
Maggie, that was beautiful.
I was also thinking as we've been sharing, I wonder if we've talked a little bit about this, but are there more things that from our training that we think we could offer parents? Because I think that is who feels the most lost or uncertainty of what do I say or how do I help them, especially if they're experiencing things like nightmares, or they're more withdrawn than they naturally are, or there's really heightened anxiety, they're having a lot of clinginess, a lot of separation anxiety, which all makes sense, right? All of those are natural responses to what happened. But what are some of the tools that we use on a regular basis, both in our practice and for you guys as parents, right, that you think may be helpful for other parents to add to their toolbox for moments like this?
I think one of the first things that comes to mind for me is trying to check in with what my kid needs. And even if it's not necessarily asking it in a way that's related, right? So I know, for example, my daughter loves one-on-one time, particularly with me. And so I might make space on a Saturday morning and just say, hey, what do you want to do today? Or what's something? Or if I know that even just sitting down and playing a game together is something that is really helpful to her, I might just suggest, hey, let's have a game night. What game would you like to play? Or let's have a movie night and pop some popcorn or cuddle up on the couch. If there's things that I know that are helpful in kind of creating that connection and sense of safety and bonded relationship, I might go ahead and throw those out. So I think knowing your kid, knowing what helps them feel comforted, feel safe, kind of feel good, and not necessarily just in a joyful, happy way, but in a solid, grounded way, going ahead and suggesting those things, or asking them for what they need, or if they're really struggling in the moment, even asking them what might help them feel a sense of calm or a sense of peace, or if they're struggling talking about losing a friend, is there something that you would like to do? My daughter wrote their green ribbons around the trees are obviously very, there's a lot of them around here. But my daughter wanted to take a Sharpie and write her friend's name on the green ribbon. Great. So we went out and she did that. And that was really meaningful for her. I would have never thought of that. She just asked me that. So taking time to kind of check in to see what ideas they can come up with, I think is really helpful. I also think it's good to keep an eye on just kind of bird's eye view of how long is this lasting and how intense are the changes, to also know as a parent, how much of this is just kind of normal response to crisis and trauma and grief versus when do I feel I need to seek additional support, and maybe getting my kid into support and getting them into play therapy, or maybe I myself as a parent am needing the support. Maybe I'm needing counseling for myself from a parenting aspect, or to manage my own anxiety about being able to separate from my kid and not worry if something terrible is going to happen unexpectedly. So being aware of those things, because just you said, Christy, I mean, there's normalcy to nightmares and clinginess. And so we can normalize some of that even to our kids. Hey, this terrible thing happened, and it's common sometimes for that to come up in our dreams, or it's common for us to want to spend a lot of time with our friends or our family. And normalizing that, I think, for a child can be helpful, especially if they're noticing it's different, and then that's causing some angst within themselves. And then that's sometimes making the anxiety even higher, because they're noticing that difference and it's feeling uncomfortable to them. So if we can normalize some of that to the child himself too, I think that can be helpful.
Yeah. And I think,
and as you were talking, oh, go ahead, Maggie.
I was just going to say, for parents, if you're listening, it's completely normal to want to feel super overprotective right now. That is a natural response. And you can also own that and say it. I'm just wanting to really keep you close right now. I love you very much. And I think just naming it and being transparent, sometimes that's so antithetical to anything we do, right? We ask people how they're doing and they say, fine, you're not fine. It's okay to be, I'm wanting to hold you really close right now and you're feeling uncomfortable with this. And that's okay.
The other thing I was going to say is in my work, sometimes parents aren't that cued into what their kids need or really know what helps support them. And so sometimes being reflective, well, what types of things do your kids ask for? When do they have meltdowns? When do just even self-reflecting on some of that stuff about are there particular things in relation to you or certain people in their life or places or a lovey, an object that really brings them comfort, right? Just helping parents process some of that stuff. I sometimes also use love languages, right? Because we have a love language of giving, but so do our kids. They also have one of receiving. So you can, there is online, you can go to love languages for kids and you can do a quick quiz to figure out, can I figure out my kid's love language of what I know about them if I'm not sure what they need? So it may be time together. It may mean I need to do really active things. I need to play sports because, or I need to jump on the trampoline because that I need to physically release this pent up energy or I don't know, whatever it may be, yeah. Right? And check with your kids. If you're not sure, ask them if that feels accurate to them, if those are the things that they love the most, or if there's something else, and you can give them some examples. And I think for me, for parents who maybe didn't grow up with that or hadn't cued into those things for their kids because our lives are busy sometimes and we get distracted and it's not your fault, right? It's okay. But how do we support them in this moment? This is one way you can go seek ways to maybe support your child and cue into maybe adding a few things into your day-to-day schedule that could be helpful for your child.
And I think schedule is also really helpful, especially with kids, especially it's summertime, right? So it's there's no schedule changing all the time, which is already can feel overwhelming. And so with my own children who are anxious, sometimes I'll be like, okay, so this is what the plan is for today, or this is what the plan is going to be for the weekend or the week. Remember, we have this on Monday, this on Tuesday, you're going to blah, blah, pop-ups on Thursday. And sometimes that can be really helpful. If you always have Friday nights or pizza and a movie night, have the pizza and a movie night, keep that routine. I think that's really helpful. And then if they need to deviate from that routine, if that's not feeling good for them, then honoring that too.
Yeah. One thing I love too about kind of what both of y'all are highlighting in checking in with the kid about kind of what they need is this is kind of secondary to the actual trauma or the crisis that has happened. You're also really helping the child develop awareness of their own emotions and what helps them cope in healthy ways and how to have healthy conversations about hard things and about feelings. And there's a lot of good that you're getting to do out of a really, I mean, the reason that you're having those conversations is horrible. There's some good in that. And I think highlighting that good can be helpful for some parents, and which also then makes me think when having conversations too with kids about these tragic things that have happened, trying to point out all the people that are helping, yeah, whether it be the search and rescue team or whether it be people that are bringing people food or all the different ways that the community is coming together to support each other, really pointing that out can be helpful and making sure that you're not doing it in a dismissive way, not in a, yeah, but look at this kind of way. So it's not invalidating, but in addition to, yes, these horrible things have happened and we're feeling really sad or feeling really scared or validating whatever experience they're having and sharing with you. And then finding a way to also help them see these positive things that are happening. I think that can also be comforting and helpful for children and adults.
And I think what you're really pointing out here, Jen, is that idea of listening, not to fix, but listening to really understand your child, right? And I think that's not a natural skill for a lot of people because we've talked about wanting to alleviate their pain or hurt or not wanting them to experience these emotions, but they are experiencing them. So sometimes reflect what you heard. You're worried, which would be a feeling response, or you're mad at so-and-so because they didn't do what you said, or right, you were hoping that blah, 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 or you're really not sure what to do right now. You feel overwhelmed. So getting kind of language out there as they're sharing with, because don't, when you repeat the exact words that they say, so yeah. kind of get the gist of what they're saying. And it's hard to do.
It's,
I mean,
so
it took us, I mean, this is part of our training, right? Is to learn how to rephrase things and say it in our own words. But I do think it's helpful mm-hmm. to be able to rephrase what they said to you without finding a solution for it. Now, there may be times that solutions are important, but I think we so quickly want to fix how they're feeling and experiencing things. So even just sitting with them, that creates a lot of safety for kids in the sense that, oh, I can go to you and talk about this and you're not going to just do that. And I always, when I work with parents, I remind them, we don't get when our partners do this, right? When we share something and they want to fix it, but we do that to kids all the time. So what do you wish your partner would say to you, right? And is that something you could model for your kids? Like, gosh, that sounds really hard, or that sounds overwhelming, right? Like that may be really helpful, or you don't that, or.
And following their lead, I think too, we can take off the teacher fixer hat, right? We don't have to hold that. And it doesn't have to be all of the time, but sometimes just letting them dictate, like they may be, so to Jen's point, you may be playing a game, family game night, and they may decide that they need to change the rules. It's okay. And so you can have, my husband says that's not, he's in it to win it and he doesn't have to change the rules, but maybe in this moment, Molly needs the rules to be different. Okay, you've decided there's a different way to do this. And just kind of following their lead, and that can be really hard. Molly spends more time telling me the rules of a game than we ever do actually playing the game. But sitting there and letting her tell me the rules lets her, one, feel in control. I'm honoring her perspective. I'm giving her that space. I'm telling her that she's valued. And so even if it's just 20 minutes of you letting your child decide, that can be really, really impactful and helpful for parents.
Yeah. And to the point that both of y'all are making that I think is so helpful to remind parents to intentionally do is to really see your kid and what their need is. So sometimes we get so wrapped up in the logistics of making something happen or how something should be or navigating the situation that we just miss what our kid needs or what they're really trying to communicate to us. So if we're intentionally looking for that, because we're trying to kind of rephrase that and give that back to them to help them feel validated in their emotions or whatever it is they're needing to do, that can help us make space for that. Because it's hard for adults to watch children hurt. And it's a very natural knee-jerk response to want to make it better and to want to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it happens with partners too, right? Because we don't want the people we love to hurt, but especially when it comes to children, the adults around them often are feeling responsible for making it better.
Yeah.
And so having those conversations with parents to remind them that that's not always our job.
And it's okay too if parents feel frustrated because of their children may be more clingy. I remember having this conversation with a friend and she said, my daughter keeps calling me over and over and over again. And I was like, okay, well, this is what's hard when you have a friend who's a play therapist. It seems like she's wanting reassurance that you will stay. And she was good. Maggie. Yeah. It's okay as a parent to feel frustrated by your child's neediness in this moment. It's okay. So I just want to give parents permission to feel that, and it's okay. And then own it, take a breath on it. Think about what it is that they might be trying to communicate with you and don't know how to communicate in that moment. And so how can you give them that reassurance? And then find spaces where you can call someone and say, this is really frustrating, and they're not going to dismiss you or fix it. You also need to find someone who will be able to hold that space for you.
I think the other, another area that sometimes, especially when a disaster or a loss happens, is we kind of let routines and schedules go away or boundaries go away. And so I also think when the world feels scary and out of control, kids need to know what limits, what parameters live around them. And you mentioned this earlier, Maggie, about telling your kids, talking about the routine, about what to expect. But I also think it's okay when you're your kid is so overwhelmed and you have reflected feelings, right? That you can also say, right? We can be as upset as we want, but people aren't for kicking, right? So we can also put a limit or say, we've hit our limit here today. I know you're still really upset. I still really want to talk to this about you, but right now we need to, because I think they need to know that we're going to help contain them a little bit too, and help put some safety nets around so that they can sense control in the environment when so much of the world feels out of control. And that's things Jen talked earlier about, monitoring what's on the TV.
Yes.
Right? How long is your child spending on the TV or on the iPad where things are popping up, right? And we can put all the parent controls we want. Kids are pretty good at getting around parent controls. I have lots of clients that I see that schools put all these controls and they're like, oh no, you just have to do this. And I'm like, what if schools know this about the Chromebooks that you send home with them? But just that idea that they do also, it's okay to stick to routines. It's okay to stick to behaviors that are in your family, what are allowed and what are not allowed. Sometimes we need to make a little space. We don't want to make so much space that now your family world also feels so out of control, right? Yeah. So it's okay to lean back in. And I was talking with a parent the other day, and their world is out of control, not because of this, but because of another kind of crisis in their life. And she said the F word. And I let her say it because she's feeling this way. And I was like, is that okay within the family system? She's like, no, I don't want her talking a sailor to everyone who walks by, right? So even just helping her figure out how to contain behavior, because they're feeling out of control. So sometimes their behaviors get out of control. But here's a limit, right? We can be upset. And thank you for telling me how upset you are. And we don't use that word in this household, right? Those are all okay things to say.
I think parents need that permission, right? Because many parents, I think they are on board with doing exactly what you talked about once we can help them understand why that's actually helpful. But I find a lot of parents come in and are overly permissive because they feel guilty. Oh, well, I feel bad that my kid's going through all this. I don't want to get them in trouble, or I don't want to cause more stress, or I don't want to add anything to their plate, or all of these things that they've kind of said to themselves in their head about why their kid needs all this extra kind of permissiveness. And so when we can just help them understand the benefits to that consistency and routine and the boundaries and rules within our environment being somewhat similar to what they're typically are, there's a lot of comfort in that. When we can explain that and help them see that, I think they are usually very much on board.
Yeah.
They just don't think about it that way naturally on their own sometimes.
Mm-mm. I want to be really mindful. I know it's close, so we need to go, but I'm so grateful that you were able to come on, Jen, and we've now been talking for an hour and a half. I don't know how we'll be able to. It may just be an extra long episode.
I think it just needs to be a long episode.
I think it does too, because I don't want to stagger it. I want this to be something that people could listen to and draw some things from and use. But I'm so grateful that you're able to do this. So for our listeners, I just texted Jen Tuesday night at 10 PM and I was like, when are you available? And so I'm really appreciative of you taking time out, especially as someone who's had such a close response to this.
Yeah. Well, thank you for thinking of me. And honestly, I feel it's been a little bit therapeutic, and in some ways, even just talking with other play therapists who kind of get it and who are also feeling impacted. And I know even at my office, just talking to the other therapists who are also impacted in various ways, whether they're feeling it as a mom or whether they know someone who is impacted or they were impacted themselves or kind of in whatever way, it feels so raw and so real and so heavy. So even to have the opportunity to talk about it kind of with the intention of it being helpful to others is really a very valuable opportunity and kind of healing for me personally, honestly.
Yeah.
No, it reminds me check on your play therapy friends, right?
Yeah.
Like check on your other counseling mental health people, because I think we tend to be empathic and we tend to carry the grief of our communities. And if we're personally impacted or our community's impacted, that it is important for that we reach out and
yes, that's
check
such a
in.
Reminder, such a great reminder.
Yeah, no, I think it's really helpful. It's just tough. And just kind of thinking about for our play therapists, I this was not planned, but the Virginia Association for Play Therapy is having a webinar on helping families heal and the play therapy from a framework of grief. And so if that's next Friday, and you can find that information on VAP, I don't know what our website is.
VAPT.org. Yep.
What great timing to have that.
I know.
I know. I just realized.
The other, if I can make just a gentle plug, this organization was incredibly helpful to us in North Carolina, but Katie Acola and her group has already put up a Amazon wish list, as well as a you can donate through Venmo if you prefer to give money. And all of that will go directly to Texas. She has found resources in Texas to connect in the local communities to get materials. And these are materials for families and communities directly impacted, as well as therapists. So her group is, this one is called Texas Play, Heal, Grow, Disaster Relief, Mental Health Support for the Texas region. And so we'll put it up on our Facebook and our social media sites, but, and there's all different things, as little as spending $3 or $4, or if you want to contribute a greater something, you can do that. I know she helped a lot of our colleagues in Western North Carolina get their playroom set back up for those that were directly impacted by the flood, but she also provided resources to school counselors, children's homes, all different things that some of these families, as well as hospitals, that may be going to get support. And so it's a great place. Anytime you see a major natural disasters, Katie will have something up and going. She did something for the wildfire. She did something for us. Maui was her first thing that she did. And so she's been really mindful. And it is a nonprofit organization, so you're contributing to something that goes right back into the community.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much for being here, and
thanks,
we appreciate
Jen.
It. And we'll have you on hopefully again soon to talk about kind of your areas of specialization, but it's been so great to have you.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
It was great.